The unsurpassed penetrating wisdom one always makes me feel very shy. Hi. Let me see. For those who don't know, a couple of you, I think. What I normally do in Cambodia is run a very small project dealing with destitute AIDS patients. It's actually not as small as it used to be. We've got three parts. The first central part, can people hear me? I keep acting like this is a microphone. The first central part is chaplaincy. Okay? We listen to people, we accompany them in their dying, we do prayers, we do chants, you know, we do Reiki and healing touch, we do whatever it takes to help people not feel alone or afraid. Underlying the whole project is the understanding that the Buddhist compassion is already completely present in the middle of suffering, but that sometimes it's hard for people to access and know that. So our whole purpose is to help people know that, especially people who are ostracized and dying and poor, and who often feel that they're somehow outside the Buddhist system because, you know, they're in this situation. Now, it's exactly the reverse, of course. The reason the Buddha taught was because we have suffering. So that all of us, in the middle of whatever suffering is going on, are precisely at the core of the teachings, in the sense that we are the reason for the teachings. Mm-hmm. But people, you know, sometimes it's helpful for people to know that, and to know that because somebody loves them. So that's the first central part of our job. And when we started working in 2000 and everybody died, you know, there were just no medicines. There was Tylenol, there was a multivitamin, small multivitamin, and there was a pill for diarrhea. And that was the cocktail of drugs for AIDS in 2000 in Cambodia. So it was usually about a year between diagnosis and death. And most people didn't know anything about what they had until they were dying. So, when antiretroviral medicine started to come in and people's lives began to be prolonged, there was a period for a couple of years that was psychologically very, very hard for people. They had lost their spouses, they had lost children, they had been prepared to die, they had been desperately ill again and again and again. And all of a sudden it became possible for them to live. But where were they going to get the means to live? How were they going to manage, especially because their health had been so completely compromised that it was a long way back, physically, emotionally, spiritually, in every possible way it was a long way back. So at that point we started doing a lot of social work. We are not a primary provider of food, money, and medicine, but we did a lot of hooking people up with organizations that could help them that way. And that's the second piece of what we do. We still do a lot of that, but it's not as crucial because most of the time in Phnom Penh, people don't get to that point anymore. You know, you can get medicines and antiretrovirals while you're still relatively strong so that your life is not destroyed. Okay, and that's a wonderful improvement. Okay, the third piece of what we do has ballooned this year. there are interstices in care. You know, the doctors are giving out medicines for free, but the patients don't have the transportation to get there. they don't have transportation to get home from the hospital. There are a lot of little bits and pieces that are not being taken on by major organizations. How we got involved in this in a large way is because 2,000 slum dwellers were moved from the center of Phnom Penh way outside the city. And they simply, you know, the 50 or so AIDS patients among them simply did not have money to go get their meds. The $5 or $7.50 it cost to get to the hospital was about all the money they had for food in a month. So this year, our material support has expanded vastly. So those are the three arms of what we do. And that's kind of bringing you up to date on it. So now I'd like to get to my topic, which is right speech. What has any of this got to do with right speech? I'll tell you in a minute. But first of all, I want to give you two working definitions, all right? This one is from Tanjaff and is very, very traditional interpretation. All right? Right speech, explained in negative terms, means avoiding four types of harmful speech. Lies, words spoken with the intention of misrepresenting the truth. Divisive speech, spoken with the intention of creating rifts between people. Harsh speech, spoken with the intention of hurting another person's feelings. And idle chatter, spoken with no purposeful intent at all. In positive terms, right speech means speaking in ways that are trustworthy, harmonious, comforting, and worth taking to heart. Okay. Katagiri Roshi has said that right speech is speech that opens up the possibility for the other person to develop in compassion. Okay, so what's that got to do with what's going on? The missing link is that my organization has developed and my staff is taking over. Now, I hate this. I don't get to see patients much anymore. They're doing it, and they're doing it brilliantly. All right? I get to do administration and bookkeeping, and I do get to do the Dhamma teaching. All right? But a lot of my time is spent in work that is, I'm sorry, inherently really boring and not what I came there for. So we've been in transition for about a year. We'll be in transition in the next year, and then we need to make decisions. Now, where we are in that transition is that in order for them to take over successfully, things have to be stabilized in the project. Expectations have to be clear. People have to be able to take the responsibility and know the responsibility they're taking. And people who cannot take that responsibility have to go. So I've had kind of two major crises about that. And both of them concern right speech intimately. I had a senior staff member, someone who had been with us since her first husband died of AIDS. She did not get the disease. But her second husband was not a nice person and younger than she was. And that was an unhappy marriage for a long time. And by that time, she was working with us. And then she finally got rid of him and she got a new boyfriend, husband, who's middle class. Now, during the last year and a half or so, her interest in the patients declined precipitously. She used to be wonderful. You know, she used to really be friends with people. You know, they really felt her heart. But that stopped happening. All right. It took some time for the person who's going to be director to talk to me about it. And then he talked to me very cautiously. This year it reached a crisis point because she was doing things that were really offensive. She would buy food for herself and sit there and eat it in front of the patients. She would, instead of going to do Reiki with the patients, she would go to the hospital or hospice and she would find an empty bed and lie down. This was not only affecting the patients, it was affecting junior staff members who didn't know what was right. And it got to a point where she was becoming quite shameless about it. We've had a foreign volunteer the last few months, and she actually did it in front of the foreign volunteer as well as everybody else. Okay, so it's time to fire her. All right, how do you do that? You know, Dick didn't want me firing her because he was afraid she would retaliate against him. I didn't discuss it with anybody else on the staff. I discussed it with my unofficial supervisor, who said, you have to get rid of her, you have to get rid of her. I said, well, maybe I should wait till I come back from the States. And he said, no, if this is what she's doing while you're there, who knows what she's going to do when you're not? Okay. He said, you need to give her a choice of resigning or being fired. Whichever she chooses, she has to sign a paper that says that the responsibility, the organization has fulfilled all its responsibilities to her. And you got to do it. Okay. So I did it while Pia was at Vipassana retreat. And I talked to nobody else ahead of time so that if she went to blame them, they could just say, I didn't know. Hmm? And then I called her in, and I had asked a friend of mine whose Khmer is really excellent to act as translator. And we presented her with her choice. And she was very, very, very upset. But I did not go into a litany of complaints about her. And I just said that I felt that she'd lost heart, and we offered her 2 months severance pay to retire, to resign, or she could be fired and get 1 month severance pay. Right. So she took the 2 months, and she signed the papers, and she cried a bunch, and she said she didn't blame us. And that seemed to be pretty okay. It was painful. Then I had to tell my team. All right, a senior person has just vanished overnight. All of them were going to be terrified about their own jobs. How do I do that? So I talked to them about the difference between, her name was Chelang. I said, the difference between Chelang, our friend, and Chelang, our colleague. And how Chelang had been a wonderful worker. And about how we still wish her very well and care what happens to her. But that as a colleague, she was doing the one thing which is truly unforgivable in our organization, which is not to care for the patients. We are not giving them their medicines. We are not providing them with housing. We are not providing them with food. All we are providing them with is love. Right? So if we are not providing them with love, we have no business being there. Right? So I explained that very carefully with a great deal of fear. And what amazed me, I mean, mean, people seem kind of nervous but relaxed that day. What has happened since she's gone is that some of the junior staff have felt free to put their hearts into the work wholeheartedly. That they've been held back, not knowing what was right, not knowing what was expected. So that the esprit de corps in my team right now is really amazing. Right, so that's case number one. It was excruciating. I couldn't talk to her about how angry and offended I was at what she was doing. Just simply needed to bypass that so that we could get the heart of the question. Now, the thing about a new husband being, she's gotten married since. The thing about her new husband being middle class is I don't think he had any idea what she was actually doing. I don't think a middle class man is going to marry a woman who is doing massage and Reiki with destitute AIDS patients. You know, we are a very hands-on team. So I think that, you know, she was being torn by aspirations to move into a higher social class and be comfortable, and, you know, salary for work that she no longer cared about. She was a tremendous caregiver for her dying husband. That's why we got to know her in the first place. But she no longer saw the patients as her relatives. She no longer saw them as other. Right? And it's completely intelligible. And the other thing I said to my staff, I said, look, we all burn out. We all get really tired from the patients, and we get tired of the patients. Right? But we come back. And how we come back is the Dhamma. How we get our strength so that when we come back stronger. That comes from our meditation practice. That comes from our Dhamma study. And she no longer cared about either of those either. So she wasn't getting the strength to do the work. Right? So that one worked out, it seems. It's 7:57. So I think I want to stop there and not tell you the second one. Okay, because there's limited time, that's too late, right? Yeah. Right speech doesn't come easily to me. The need to take a deep breath, look at the situation as calmly as possible, look at my own intentions in the situation. What is it I want to accomplish here? How can I do that most effectively? How can I do that in a way that opens things up for the other person, even when what I'm doing is firing them? This is not natural to me. This runs completely against the grain of most of my life. What I'm finding is that it is a tremendous discipline. And the energy that comes from it is wonderful. Okay. Thank you. All right. Questions? Got time for a couple. Yeah. None? Yep.
Okay, so you're seeing your role change. Is how is going to be in the future? Are you moving to more hands-on?
I can't in this situation. You know, I mean, the point is, they're trained, they're wonderful, they're within a year of being able to teach. I can't recapture that ground at their expense. No, I've got to move out. So that's probably going to happen in at the end of 2008. And the question is whether they can take over successfully not only the hands-on work, which they're fine with, but the administration and running and all the rest of that. And for that, they need clarity. They need to know what the tasks are. They need to know who's responsible for what. Pia, who is those World War II movies where you've got the officer who's there and you've got the sergeant who runs the show? That's Pia. He runs our place. He's the only one of us with a level head. And he's terrific. He's smart. He's compassionate. He's honest. But his English is not very good, and he's shy about it. He doesn't read it or write it. He's completely meticulous in his honesty, but he doesn't want responsibility for finances beyond the immediate dealing with them. He's not an administrator. We brought in someone who's had experience administrating in non-governmental institutions, and we can't use her for it because her experience has gotten her. She's interested in how much is a per diem. And she came from a higher social class, and it took some effort for her to see that my staff knows more than she does about taking care of patients. Because she assumed that because she was educated, she was better at everything. Now, this was the second story I was going to tell you. The amazing thing about her is that at a 3-month review, when I told her I wasn't moving her into administration, that I wanted her to concentrate on her meditation practice and her patient care, that she got it. And she's doing that. And she's learning. And she's treating the rest of the staff with respect. Yeah. But if they're going to make it, if they're going to take over and continue, then this stuff has to be very clear. If they're not going to take over, if they're going to disperse and go elsewhere, they have to take that clarity and strength with them. They have to have that for their lives and for wherever they go. So my task in that sense is to work with them to build the stability and the strength for whichever happens. And then I want to study some Dhamma. I'm going to be 65 in March of 2009. I was telling Angie, I want to go and retreat for a year. So they got to be off my lands by then. And then, afterwards, maybe I'll get someplace where I can do hands-on again. Because hands-on is where the action is. I mean, I spent all these years learning how to do it. And those of you who've seen me year after year after year struggling know how hard it's been. And finally, I know how to do it, and I don't get to. Other questions? Yeah.
I have a question, but it may be much too big. I thought your explanation of right speech was very helpful and well illustrated.
Thank you.
I wondered what the relationship, obviously, in the larger context, is between right speech and right living.
Let's do that over tea. Okay. Yeah. All right. So we're at 8:03. I was pretty good for me.
Do you want to hear everyone's name?
Yes, I definitely want to hear everybody's name, even the names I know. Please.
Kitty.
Yes.
Samia.
Yeah.
Carolyn.
Is that me? Carolyn's an old friend.
Wendy.
Benton.
Britt.
Arno.
Yep.
Randy.
Hi. Okay. Thank you. Thank everybody.